He'd begun taking his teaching with almost ominous seriousness these past months. He'd always prepared for his classes, but there was a kind of heaviness to the way he went about preparing now, writing everything down, rehearsing his notes aloud, as if he were trying to make certain that nothing of significance would remain unsaid, as if he felt the future hung on every idea he taught. I never knew when he went to sleep. No matter what time I got to bed, he was still in his study. He had never regained the weight he had lost during the weeks he had spent in the hospital after his heart attack, and he was always tired, his face pale and gaunt, his eyes watery. He stood now in the doorway to his study, wearing the woolen sweater, the scarf, and the round black skullcap. His feet were in bedroom slippers, and his trousers were creased from all the sitting over the typewriter. He was visibly tired, and his voice cracked a few times as he asked me what Danny had been so excited about. He'd heard him through the door, he said. I told him about Danny's misery over Professor Appleman and experimental psychology. He listened intently, then came into my room and sat down on my bed with a sigh. "So," he said, "Danny is discovering that Freud is not God." I told him at least to talk it over with Professor Appleman. "And?" "He'll talk to him next week." "Experimental psychology," my father mused. "I know nothing about it." He said there was a lot of math in it. "Ah, and Danny doesn't like mathematics." "He hates it," he says. He's feeling pretty low. He feels he wasted 2 years reading Freud. My father smiled and shook his head, but remained silent. "Professor Appleman sounds a lot like Professor Flesser," I said. "Professor Abraham Flesser was my logic teacher, an avowed empiricist, and an enemy of what he called obscurantist continental philosophies, which, he explained, included everything that had happened in German philosophy from Fichte to Heidegger, with the exception of Weihinger and one or two others." My father wanted to know what it was the two professors had in common, and I told him what Professor Appleman had said about psychology being a science only to the extent to which its hypotheses can be mathematized. "Professor Flesser made the same remark once about biology," I said. "You talk about biology in a symbolic logic class?" my father asked. "We were discussing inductive logic." "Ah, of course. The point about mathematizing hypotheses was made by Kant. It is one of the programs of the Vienna Circle logical positivists." "Who?" "Not now, Reuven. It's too late and I'm tired. You should go to sleep soon. Take advantage of the nights when you have no schoolwork."
"You'll be working late tonight, Abba?"
"Yes."
"You're not taking care of yourself, you know. Your voice sounds awful." He sighed again.
"It's a bad cold," he said.
"Does Dr. Grossman know you're working so hard?"
"Dr. Grossman worries a little bit too much about me," he said, smiling.
"Are you going for another checkup soon?"
"Soon," he said. "I'm feeling fine, Reuven. You worry like Dr. Grossman. Worry better about your schoolwork." "I'm fine."
"How many fathers do I have?" I asked. He didn't say anything, but he blinked his eyes a few times. "I wish you'd take it a little easy," I said.
"This is not a time to take things easy, Reuven. You read what is happening in Palestine."
I nodded slowly.
"This is a time to take things easy?" my father asked, his hoarse voice rising. "The Haganah and Irgun boys who die are taking it easy?"
He was talking about what was going on in Palestine. Two Englishmen, an army major and a judge, had been kidnapped recently by the Irgun, the Jewish terrorist group in Palestine, and were being held as hostages. A captured member of the Irgun, Dov Gruner, had been sentenced to hanging by the British, and the Irgun had announced instant retaliation against these hostages should the sentence be carried out. This was the latest of a growing list of terrorist activities against the British Army in Palestine. While the Irgun engaged in terror, blowing up trains, attacking police stations, cutting communications lines, the Haganah continued smuggling Jews through the British naval blockade in defiance of the British Colonial Office, which had sealed Palestine off to further Jewish immigration. Rarely did a week go by now without a new act of terror against the British. My father would read the newspaper accounts of these activities, and I could see the anguish in his eyes. He hated violence and bloodshed, and had an intense distaste for the terrorist policy of the Irgun. But he hated the British non-immigration policy even more. Irgun blood was being shed for the sake of a future Jewish state, and he found it difficult to give voice to his feelings of opposition to the acts of terror that were regularly making front-page headlines now. Invariably, the headlines spurred him on to new bursts of Zionist activity and to loud, excited justification of the way he was driving himself in his fundraising and speech-making efforts in behalf of a Jewish state. I could see he was beginning to get excited now, too, so to change the subject quickly, I told him Reb Saunders had sent his regards. "He wonders why he doesn't see me," I said. But my father didn't seem to have heard me. He sat on the bed, lost in thought. We were quiet for a long time. Then he stirred and said softly, "Reuven, do you know what the rabbis tell us God said to Moses when he was about to die?" I stared at him. "No," I heard myself say. "He said to Moses, 'You have toiled and labored. Now you are worthy of rest.'" I stared at him and didn't say anything. "You're no longer a child, Reuven," my father went on. "It is almost possible to see the way your mind is growing. And your heart, too. Inductive logic, Freud, experimental psychology, mathematizing hypotheses, scientific study of the Talmud. 3 years ago, you were still a child. You have become a small giant since the day Danny's ball struck your eye. You do not see it, but I see it. And it is a beautiful thing to see. So listen to what I'm going to tell you." He paused for a moment, as if considering his next words carefully, then continued. "Human beings don't live forever, Reuven. We live less than the time it takes to blink an eye, if we measure our lives against eternity. So it may be asked, what value is there to a human life? There's so much pain in the world. What does it mean to have to suffer so much if our lives are nothing more than the blink of an eye?" He paused again, his eyes misty now, then went on. "I learned a long time ago, Reuven, that a blink of an eye in itself is nothing. But the eye that blinks, that is something. A span of life is nothing. But the man who lives that span, he is something. He can fill that tiny span with meaning. So its quality is immeasurable, though its quantity may be insignificant. Do you understand what I'm saying? A man must fill his life with meaning. Meaning is not automatically given to life. It is hard work to fill one's life with meaning. That I do not think you understand yet. A life filled with meaning is worthy of rest. I want to be worthy of rest when I am no longer here. Do you understand what I'm saying?" I nodded, feeling myself cold with dread. That was the first time my father had ever talked to me of his death, and his words seemed to have filled the room with a gray mist that blurred my vision and stung as I breathed. My father looked at me, then sighed quietly. "I was a little too blunt," he said. "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to hurt you." I couldn't say anything. "I'll live for many more years, with God's help," my father said, trying a smile. "Between my son and my doctor, I'll probably live to be a very old man. The gray mist seemed to part. I took a deep breath. I could feel cold sweat running down my back. "Are you angry at me, Reuven?" I shook my head. I did not want to sound morbid. I only wanted to tell you that I'm doing things I consider very important now. If I couldn't do these things, my life would have no value. Merely to live, merely to exist, what sense is there to it? A fly also lives. I didn't say anything. The mist was gone now. I found the palms of my hands were cold with sweat. "I'm sorry," my father said quietly. "I can see I upset you." "You frightened me," I heard myself say. "I'm sorry." "Will you please go for that checkup?" "Yes," my father said. "You really frightened me talking that way. Are you sure you're all right?" "I have a bad cold," my father said. "But I'm fine otherwise." "You'll go for that checkup?"
"I will call Dr. Grossman tomorrow and make an appointment for next week. All right?"
"Yes."
"Fine. My young logician is satisfied. Good. Let us talk of happier things. I didn't tell you that I saw Jack Rose yesterday. He gave me $1,000 check for the Jewish National Fund."
"Another $1,000?
Jack Rose and my father had been boyhood friends in Russia and had come to America on the same boat. He was now a wealthy furrier and a thoroughly non-observant Jew. Yet, 6 months ago, he had given my father $1,000 contribution to our synagogue.
"It is strange what is happening," my father said.
"And it is exciting." "Jack is on the building committee of a synagogue."
"Yes, he joined a synagogue. Not for himself, he told me. For his grandchildren.
He's helping them put up a new building so his grandchildren can go to a modern synagogue and have a good Jewish education. It's beginning to happen everywhere in America. A religious renaissance, some call it."
"I can't see Jack Rose in a synagogue," I said.
On the few occasions when he had been over to our apartment, I'd found his open disregard for Jewish tradition distasteful. He was a short man with round, pink features, always immaculately dressed, always smoking long, expensive cigars. Once I asked my father why they had remained friends. Their views about almost everything of importance were so different. He replied by expressing dismay at my question. "Honest differences of opinion should never be permitted to destroy a friendship," he told me.
"Haven't you learned that yet, Reuven?"
Now I was tempted to tell my father that Jack Rose was probably using his money to solve a bad conscience, but I didn't. Instead, I said a little scornfully, "I don't envy his rabbi." My father shook his head soberly.
"Why not?
You should envy him, Reuven. American Jews have begun to return to the synagogue."
"God help us if synagogues fill up with Jack Roses."
"They will fill up with Jack Roses, and it will be the task of rabbis to educate them. It will be your task if you become a rabbi."
I looked at him.
"If you become a rabbi," my father said, smiling at me warmly.
"When I become a rabbi, you mean?"
My father nodded, still smiling.
"You would have been a fine university professor," he said.
"I'd have liked you to become a university professor. But I think you've already decided, am I right?"
"Yes," I said.
"Even with a synagogue full of Jack Roses?"
"Even with a synagogue full of Jack Roses," I said. "God help me."
"America needs rabbis," my father said.
"Well, it's better than being a boxer," I told him.
My father looked puzzled.
"A bad joke," I said.
"Will you have some tea with me?"
I said I would.
"Come, let us have some tea and continue to talk about happy things." So we drank tea and talked some more. My father told me about the Zionist activities he was engaged in,
the speeches he was making, the funds he was raising. He said that in a year or two, the crisis in Palestine would come to a head. There would be terrible bloodshed, he predicted, unless the British would give over the problem to the United Nations. Many American Jews were not yet aware of what was going on, he said. The English papers didn't tell the entire story. A Jew had to read the Yiddish press now if he wished to know everything that was happening in Palestine. American Jews had to be awakened to the problem of a Jewish state. His Zionist group was planning a mass rally in Madison Square Garden, he told me. The publicity would be going out this week, and there'd be a large ad soon in the New York Times announcing the rally. It was scheduled for late February. I wonder how Reb Saunders will feel when he finds out that Danny is the friend of the son of a Zionist, I mused. I had told my father about Reb Saunders' explosion. My father sighed. Reb Saunders sits and waits for the Messiah, he said. I am tired of waiting. Now is the time to bring the Messiah, not to wait for him. We finished our tea. My father returned to his study, and I went to bed. I had some terrible dreams that night, but I could remember none of them when I woke in the morning. It was Friday, and I had nothing planned. Danny always spent his morning studying Talmud, so I decided that rather than waste the day, I would go over to the college library and see if I could find something on experimental psychology. It was a little before 10 o'clock when I woke, and my father had already left to teach, so Manya served me breakfast alone, calling me a lazy sleepyhead, and a few other things in Russian which I didn't understand, and then I took the trolley over to the college. The library had a large section devoted to psychology. I found some books on experimental psychology and leafed through them slowly, then checked the indexes and bibliographies. What I discovered made it very clear why Danny was feeling so miserable. I'd chosen the books at random, but even a quick glance at them made it apparent that they were all structured along similar lines. They dealt only with experimental data, and were filled with graphs, charts, tables, photographs of devices for the measuring of auditory, visual, and tactile responses, and with mathematical translations of laboratory findings. Most of the books didn't even cite Freud in their bibliographies. In one book, Freud was referred to only once, and the passage was far from complimentary. I checked the indexes under unconscious. Some of the books didn't even have it listed. One book had this to say: "It is impossible here to discuss the new psychology of the unconscious, but exaggerated as are many of the statements made as to the revolution in psychology caused by psychoanalysis, there is little doubt that it has influenced psychology permanently. And it is well that the teacher should study something of it, partly because of its suggestiveness in many parts of his work, and partly to be on guard against the exaggerated statements of extremists and the uncritical advocacy of freedom from all discipline based upon them." That uncritical advocacy of freedom from all discipline sounded a lot like Professor Appleman. Then I found something that really sounded like Professor Appleman. "Magic depends on tradition and belief. It doesn't welcome observation, nor does it profit by experiment. On the other hand, science is based on experience. It is open to correction by observation and experiment." The book in which I found that passage was full of tables and graphs showing the results of experiments on frogs, salamanders, rats, apes, and human beings. It didn't mention Freud or the unconscious anywhere. I felt sorry for Danny. He'd spent 2 years studying about the mind from the point of view of Freudian analysis. Now he was studying about the mind from the point of view of physiology. I understood what he'd meant when he said that experimental psychology had nothing to do with the human mind. In terms of psychoanalytic theory, it had very little to do with the human mind. But psychoanalysis aside, I thought the books were very valuable. How else could a science of psychology be built except by laboratory findings? And what else could you do in a laboratory except experiment with the physiology of animals and men? How could you experiment with their minds? How could anyone subject Freud's concept of the unconscious to a laboratory test? Poor Danny, I thought. Professor Appleman with his experimental psychology is torturing your mind. And your father with his bizarre silence, which I still couldn't understand, no matter how often I thought about it, is torturing your soul. I went home feeling sad and a little helpless. Danny would have to work out his own problem. I couldn't help him much with psychology. The second semester of college began the following Monday, and during lunch, Danny told me he planned to speak to Professor Appleman that afternoon. He looked tense and nervous. I suggested that he be polite but honest, and that he listen to what Appleman might have to say. I was a little nervous myself, but I told him I'd done some reading in experimental psychology on Friday and that I thought it had a lot to contribute. How could you have a science without experimentation? I wanted to know. And how could anyone experiment on the unconscious, which, by definition, seemed to defy laboratory techniques of testing? I saw Danny become tight-lipped with anger. "Thanks a lot," he said bitterly. "That's just what I need now. A kick in the pants for my best friend." "I'm telling you how I feel," I said.
"And I'm telling you how I feel," he almost shouted. "Thanks a million."
He stormed angrily out of the lunchroom, leaving me to finish the meal alone. We usually met outside the building after our final class and went home together, but that evening, he didn't show up. I waited about half an hour, then went home alone. The next morning, as I walked up Lee Avenue, I saw him waiting for me in front of the synagogue where my father and I prayed. "Where were you last night?" he asked. "I waited half an hour," I said. "What time did you get out?"
"A quarter after seven."
"You were with him an hour?"
"We had a long talk. Listen, I'm sorry I blew up like that yesterday at lunch."
I told him I had a pretty thick skin, and besides, what was a friend for if not to be blown up at every now and then? We were walking toward the trolley station. It was a bitter cold morning. Danny's earlocks lifted and fell in the stiff wind that blew through the streets. "What happened?" I asked.
"It's a long story," Danny said, looking at me sideways and grinning. "We had a long talk about Freud, Freudian, psychology, psychoanalysis, and God."
"And?"
"He's a very fine person. He said he's been waiting all term for me to talk to him." I didn't say anything, but now I was grinning.
"Anyway, he knows Freud forwards and backwards. He told me that he wasn't objecting to Freud's conclusions as much as to his methodology. He said Freud's approach was based on his own limited experiences. He generalized on the basis of a few instances, a few private patients."
"That's the problem of induction in a nutshell," I said. "How do you justify jumping from a few instances to a generalization?"
"I don't know anything about the problem of induction," Danny said. "That's your department."
"Appleman said something else, though, that made a lot of sense to me. He admitted that Freud was a genius and a cautious scientist, but he said that Freud evolved a theory of behavior based only on the study of abnormal cases. He said that experimental psychology was interested in applying the methodology of the natural sciences to discover how all human beings behaved. It doesn't generalize about personality behavior only on the basis of a certain segment of people."
"That makes a lot of sense."
"Well, well," I said, grinning broadly.
"He also said his quarrel was mainly with the Freudians, not so much with Freud himself. He said they were happy to earn their fat fees as analysts and refused to let anyone challenge their hypotheses."
"There's our trolley," I said. "Come on."
The trolley was waiting for a light, and we made it just in time. Some of the people inside stared curiously at Danny as he went up the aisle looking for seats. I'd grown accustomed to people staring at Danny, at his beard and side curls.
But Danny had become increasingly self-conscious about his appearance ever since the time he had read Gretz on Hasidism. He looked straight ahead, trying to ignore the stares. We found seats in the rear of the trolley and sat down. "So he said analysts don't let anyone challenge their hypotheses," I said. "What happened then?" "Well, we talked a lot about experimental psychology. He told me that it was almost impossible to study human subjects because it was too difficult to control the experiments. He said we use rats because we can vary the conditions. He repeated a lot of things he'd already said in class, but he made a lot more sense this time. At least, I think he made a lot more sense. Maybe after what he said about Freud being a genius, I was just more willing to listen to him. He said he admired my knowledge of Freud, but that in science, no one was God, not even Einstein. He said even in religion, people differed about what God was. So why shouldn't scientists take issue with other scientists? I couldn't argue with that. He said experimental psychology would be a healthy balance to my knowledge of Freud. Maybe. I still don't think it has anything to do with the human mind. It's more physiology than anything else, I think. Anyway, Appleman told me that if I had any problem with math, he was willing to help me as much as he could. But his time is limited, he said. So he suggested I get a friend to help me on a regular basis. I didn't say anything. He looked at me and grinned. Okay, I said. I don't charge very much. It won't make me love running rats through mazes, Danny said. But at least he's sympathetic. He's really a fine person. I smiled at him but didn't say anything. Then I noticed the psychology textbook he was carrying. It was one of the books I had seen on Friday that didn't mention Freud once. I asked him what he thought of it, and he said it was a grind. If I ever get to love experimental psychology after this book, I'll assume the Messiah has come, he said. Well, just call on your friendly Tzaddik for help, I told him. He looked at me queerly. I meant, me? I said. He looked away and didn't say anything. We rode the rest of the way to school, in silence. So I began coaching Danny in math. He caught on very quickly, mostly by memorizing steps and procedures. He wasn't really interested in the why of a mathematical problem, but in the how. I enjoyed coaching him and learned a lot of experimental psychology. I found it fascinating, a lot more substantial and scientific than Freud had been, and a lot more fruitful in terms of expanding testable knowledge on how human beings thought and learned. Throughout the early weeks of February, Danny and I met in the lunchroom, sat at a table by ourselves, and discussed the difficulties he was having with his mathematical translations of psychological experiments. I showed him how to set up his graphs, how to utilize the tables in his textbook, and how to reduce experimental findings to mathematical formulas. I also kept arguing for the value of experimentation. Danny remained convinced of his original argument that experimental psychology had nothing to do with the human mind, though he began to see its value as an aid to learning theory and intelligence testing. His frustration over it went up and down like a barometer, the climate being the extent to which he was able to comprehend and resolve whatever mathematical problem preoccupied him at any given moment. I saw very little of my father during those early weeks of February. Except for breakfast, supper, and Shabbat, he was never home. Sometime between 11 and 12 every night, he'd return from wherever he'd been, have a glass of tea, spend a few minutes with me in my room, then go into his study. I never knew what time he went to bed, though his tired, stooped body and his haggard face made it clear that he was sleeping very little. He'd gone for his checkup, and Dr. Grossman had been satisfied with his health, though he had suggested that he get more rest. My father took a vitamin pill every morning now with his orange juice, but they didn't seem to be doing much good. He completely ignored Dr. Grossman's suggestion that he rest more, and every time I brought up the subject, he either waved it away or talked about the violence now going on in Palestine. It was impossible to talk to him about his health.
There was nothing more important to him now than the two ideas around which his life revolved: the education of American Jewry and a Jewish state in Palestine. So he continued teaching his adult classes and planning for the Madison Square Garden rally, due to take place in the last week of February. Not only had my home life been affected by Palestine, but my school life as well. Every shade of Zionist thought was represented in Hirsch College, from the revisionists, who supported the Irgun, to the Neturei Karta, the guardians of the city being Jerusalem. This latter group was composed of severely Orthodox Jews who, like Reb Saunders, despised all efforts aimed at the establishment of a Jewish state prior to the advent of the Messiah. A recent influx of Hungarian Jews into our neighborhood had swelled their ranks, and they formed a small but highly vocal element of the school student population. Even the rabbinic faculty was split, most of the rabbis voicing their hope for a Jewish state, some of them opposing it, while all of the college faculty seemed to be for it. There were endless discussions during the afternoon college hours about the problem of dual loyalty. What sort of allegiance could an American Jew have toward a foreign Jewish state? And invariably, these arguments revolved around this hypothetical question: on what side would an American Jew fight should America ever declare war against a Jewish state? I always answered that the question was silly. America would never send Jews to fight against a Jewish state. During the Second World War, she had sent Japanese Americans to fight the Germans, not the Japanese. But my answer never seemed to satisfy anyone. What if America did want to send Jews to fight against a Jewish state? The theorists countered. What then? The discussions were quite heated at times, but they went on only among those students and teachers who favored a Jewish state. Many of the Hasidim ignored the question completely. Despising as they did all efforts in behalf of a Jewish state, they despised as well all discussions that had to do with even its possible existence. They called such discussions bitul Torah, time taken away from the study of Torah, and looked upon all the disputants with icy disgust. Toward the middle of February, the various factions began to firm up their ranks as the entire spectrum of Zionist youth movements moved into the school in a drive for membership, the second such drive since I had entered the college. From that time on, the recruitment drive lasted a few days, every student's position was clearly defined by the Zionist philosophy of the group he joined. Most of the pro-Zionist students, myself included, joined a religious Zionist youth group. A few joined the youth arm of the revisionists. The anti-Zionist students remained aloof, bitter, disdainful of our Zionism. In the lunchroom one day, one of the Hasidim accused a member of the revisionist youth group of being worse than Hitler. Hitler had only succeeded in destroying the Jewish body, he shouted in Yiddish. But the revisionists were trying to destroy the Jewish soul. There was almost a fistfight, and the two students were kept apart with difficulty by members of their respective sides. The incident left a bitter taste in everyone's mouth, and succeeded only in increasing the tension between the pro-Zionist and anti-Zionist students. As I expected, Danny didn't join any of the Zionist groups. Privately, he told me he wanted to join my group, but he couldn't. Did I remember his father's explosion over Zionism? He wanted to know. I told him I had had nightmares about that explosion. How would I like an explosion like that with every meal? Danny asked me. I didn't think the question required an answer and told him so. Danny nodded grimly. Besides, he added, the anti-Zionists among the Hasidic students looked upon him as their leader. How would it be if he joined a Zionist group? It would do nothing but add to the already existing bitterness. He was trapped by his beard and earlocks, he said, and there was nothing he could do. But one day, he didn't finish the sentence. He remained aloof, however, never participating in the quarrels between the pro-Zionist and anti-Zionist groups. And during the near fistfight in the lunchroom, his face went rigid as stone,
and I saw him look with hatred at the Hasidic student who had started the quarrel. But he said nothing. And after the disputants had been half-carried, half-dragged from the lunchroom, he returned immediately to the math problem we'd been discussing. In the third week of February, the newspapers reported that British Foreign Minister Bevin had announced his intention to bring the Palestine issue to the United Nations in September. My father was delighted, despite the fact that the news cost him some extra nights of work rewriting the speech he was to give at the rally. He read the speech to me the Shabbat afternoon before the rally. In it, he described the 2,000-year-old Jewish dream of a return to Zion, the Jewish blood that had been shed through the centuries, the indifference of the world to the problem of a Jewish homeland, the desperate need to arouse the world to the realization of how vital it was that such a homeland be established immediately on the soil of Palestine. Where else could the remnant of Jewry that had escaped Hitler's ovens go? The slaughter of 6 million Jews would have meaning only on the day a Jewish state was established. Only then would their sacrifice begin to make some sense. Only then would the songs of faith they had sung on their way to the gas chambers take on meaning. Only then would Jewry again become a light to the world, as Ahad Ha'am had foreseen. I was deeply moved by the speech, and I was very proud of my father. It was wonderful to know that he'd soon be standing in front of thousands of people reading the same words he read to me that Shabbat. The day before the scheduled date of the Madison Square Garden rally, there was a violent snowstorm, and my father walked like a ghost through our apartment, staring white-faced out the window at the swirling snow. It fell the entire day, then stopped. The city struggled to free itself of its white burden, but the streets remained choked all the next day, and my father left in the evening for the rally wearing a look of doom, his face ashen. I couldn't go with him because I had a logic exam the next day and had to remain home to study. I forced myself to concentrate on the logic problems, but somehow they seemed inconsequential to me. I kept seeing my father standing at the rostrum in front of a vast empty hall, speaking to seats made vacant by the snow. I dreaded the moment I would hear his key in the lock of our apartment door. I did as much studying as I could, hating Professor Flesser for springing the exam on us the way he'd done. Then I wandered aimlessly through the apartment, thinking how stupid it was to have all my father's work ruined by something like a snowstorm. Shortly before 1 a.m, I heard him open the door. I was in the kitchen drinking milk, and I ran out into the hallway. His face was flushed with excitement. The rally had been a wild success. The garden had been packed, and 2,000 people had stood on the street outside listening to the speeches over loudspeakers. He was elated. We sat at the kitchen table, and he told me all about it. The police had blocked off the street. The crowd's response to the speeches, urging an end to the British mandate and the establishment of a Jewish state, had been overwhelming. My father's talk had been wildly cheered. A senator, who had spoken earlier, had come up to him after the rally and had enthusiastically shaken his hand, promising him his complete support. There was no question that the rally had been a success. It had been a stunning success, despite the snow-choked streets. It was after 3 a.m. when we finally went to bed. The rally made the front pages of all the New York papers the next day. The English papers carried excerpts of the senator's speech and briefly mentioned my father, but all the Yiddish papers quoted him extensively. I was the center of considerable attention on the part of the Zionist students and the target of icy hatred from the ranks of the anti-Zionists. I paid no attention to the fact that Danny did not meet me in the lunchroom. Between my fatigue over lack of sleep and my excitement over the rally, I did quite poorly in the logic exam. But I didn't care. Logic didn't seem at all important now. I kept seeing my father's excited face and heard his voice telling me over and over again about the rally. That evening, I waited for Danny more than half an hour, just inside the double door of the school, before I decided to go home alone. The next morning, he wasn't in front of the synagogue. I waited as long as I could, then took the trolley to school. I was sitting at a table preparing for the Talmud session when I saw him pass me and nod his head in the direction of the door. He looked white-faced and grim, and he was blinking his eyes nervously. He went out, and a moment later I followed. I saw him go into the bathroom, and I went in after him. The bathroom was empty. Danny was urinating into one of the urinals. I stood next to him and assumed the urinating position. "Was he all right?" I wanted to know. "He wasn't all right," he told me bitterly. His father had read the account of the rally in the Yiddish press. There had been an explosion yesterday at breakfast, last night at supper, and this morning again at breakfast. Danny was not to see me, talk to me, listen to me, be found within 4 feet of me. My father and I had been excommunicated from the Saunders family. If Reb Saunders even once heard of Danny being anywhere in my presence, he would remove him immediately from the college and send him to an out-of-town yeshiva for his rabbinic ordination. There would be no college education, no bachelor's degree, nothing. Just a rabbinic ordination. If we tried meeting in secret, Reb Saunders would find out about it. My father's speech had done it. Reb Saunders didn't mind his son reading forbidden books, but never would he let his son be the friend of the son of a man who was advocating the establishment of a secular Jewish state run by Jewish goyim. It was even dangerous for Danny to meet me in the bathroom, but he had to tell me. As if to emphasize how dangerous it was, a Hasidic student came into the bathroom just then, took one look at me, and chose the urinal farthest away from me. A moment later, Danny walked out. When I came into the hallway, he was gone. I'd expected it, but now that it had happened, I couldn't believe it. Reb Saunders had drawn the line not at secular literature, not at Freud, assuming he knew somehow that Danny had been reading Freud, but at Zionism. I found it impossible to believe. My father and I had been excommunicated, not only from the Saunders family, apparently, but also from the anti-Zionist element of the Hasidic student body. They avoided all contact with me, and even stepped out of my way so I wouldn't brush against them in the halls. Occasionally I overheard them talking about the Malter Goyim. During lunch, I sat at a table with some of my non-Hasidic classmates and stared at the section of the room the Hasidic students always took for themselves. They sat together in the lunchroom, and my eyes moved slowly over them, over their dark clothes, fringes, beards, and earlocks, and it seemed to me that every word they were saying was directed against me and my father. Danny sat among them, silent, his face tight. His eyes caught mine, held, then looked slowly away. I felt cold with the look of helpless pleading I saw in them. It seemed so incredible to me, so outrageously absurd. Not Freud, but Zionism had finally shattered our friendship. I went through the rest of the day alternating between violent rage at Reb Saunders' blindness and anguished frustration at Danny's helplessness. When I told my father about it that night, he listened in silence. He was quiet for a long time afterward. Then he sighed and shook his head, his eyes misty. He had known it would happen, he said sadly. How could it not happen? I don't understand it, Abba. I was almost in tears. In a million years, I'll never understand it. He let Danny read all the books I gave him. He let us be friends all these years, even though he knew I was your son. Now he breaks us up over this? I just don't understand it. Reuven, what went on between you and Danny all these years was private. Who really knew? It was probably not difficult for Reb Saunders to answer questions from his followers, assuming there were any questions, which I doubt, simply by saying that I was at least an observer of the commandments. But he has no answer anymore to my Zionism. What can he tell his people now? Nothing. He had to do what he did. How could he let you continue to be friends? I'm sorry I was the cause of it. I brought you together, and now I'm the cause of your separation. I'm deeply sorry.
He's such a fanatic, I almost shouted.
Reuven, my father said quietly, the fanaticism of men like Reb Saunders kept us alive for 2,000 years of exile. If the Jews of Palestine have an ounce of that same fanaticism and use it wisely, we will soon have a Jewish state. I couldn't say anything else. I was afraid my anger would bring me to say the wrong words. I went to bed early that night, but lay awake a long time, trying to remember all the things Danny and I had done together since the Sunday afternoon his ball had struck me in the eye.
Chapter 14. For the rest of that semester, Danny and I ate in the same lunchroom, attended the same classes, studied in the same school synagogue, and often rode in the same trolley car, and never said a single word to each other. Our eyes met frequently, but our lips exchanged nothing. I lost all direct contact with him. It was an agony to sit in the same class with him, to pass him in the hallway, to see him in a trolley, to come in and out of the school building with him and not say a word. I grew to hate Reb Saunders with a venomous passion that frightened me at times, and I consoled myself with wild fantasies of what I would do to him if he ever fell into my hands. It was an ugly time, and it began to affect my schoolwork to a point where some of my college teachers called me into their offices and wanted to know what was happening. They expected better from me than they were receiving. I made vague allusions to personal problems and went away from them cold with despair. I talked about it with my father as often as I could, but there seemed to be little he could do to help me. He would listen somberly, sigh, and repeat that he had no intention of quarreling with Reb Saunders. He respected his position, in spite of its fanaticism. I wondered often during those months whether Danny was also going through those same dreadful experiences. I saw him frequently. He seemed to be losing weight, and I noticed he was wearing different eyeglasses. But he was very carefully avoiding me, and I knew enough to stay away from him. I didn't want word to get back to his father that we had been seen together. I hated the silence between us, and thought it unimaginable that Danny and his father never really talked. Silence was ugly. It was black. It leered. It was cancerous. It was death. I hated it, and I hated Reb Saunders for forcing it upon me and his son. I never knew myself capable of the kind of hatred I felt toward Reb Saunders all through that semester. It became, finally, a blind, raging fury, and I would find myself trembling with it at odd moments of the day, waiting to get into a trolley car, walking into a bathroom, sitting in the lunchroom, or reading in the library. And my father only added to it, for whenever I began to talk to him of my feelings toward Reb Saunders, he invariably countered by defending him and by asserting that the faith of Jews like Reb Saunders had kept us alive through 2,000 years of violent persecution. He disagreed with Reb Saunders, yes, but he would countenance no slander against his name or his position. Ideas should be fought with ideas, my father said, not with blind passion. If Reb Saunders was fighting him with passion, that didn't mean that my father had to fight Reb Saunders with passion. And Reb Saunders was fighting with passion. He had organized some of the Hasidic rebbes in the neighborhood into a group called the League for a Religious Eretz Yisrael. The work of this organization had begun mildly enough in early March with the handing out of leaflets. Its aims were clear. No Jewish homeland without the Torah at its center. Therefore, no Jewish homeland until the coming of the Messiah. a Jewish homeland created by Jewish goyim was to be considered contaminated and an open desecration of the name of God. By the end of March, however, the leaflets had become inflammatory in tone, threatening excommunication to all in the neighborhood who displayed allegiance to Zionism, even at one point threatening to boycott neighborhood stores owned by Jews who contributed to, participated in, or were sympathetic with Zionist activities. A mass anti-Zionist rally was announced for a date a few days before Passover. It was poorly attended, but it made some of the English papers, and the reports of what had been said were ugly. The student body of the college was tense with suppressed violence. An angry fistfight broke out in a classroom one afternoon, and it was only because the dean threatened immediate expulsion to any future participants in such quarrels that more fistfights were avoided. But the tension was felt everywhere. It spilled over into our studies, and arguments over Milton, Talleyrand, or deductive procedures and logic were often clear substitutes for the outlawed fistfights over Zionism. I took the finals in the middle of June and came away from them sick with despair. I'd botched my midterms badly, and I didn't do too much better on my finals. My father didn't say a word when he saw my report card at the end of June. Both of us were by that time looking forward very eagerly to the quiet month of August, when we would be together in the cottage near Peekskill. It had been a terrible time these past 4 months, and we wanted to get away from the city. But the cottage proved to be not far enough away. We took to it the horrifying news that the Irgun had hanged 2 innocent British sergeants in retaliation for the 3 Irgunists who were hanged on the 29th of July. My father was outraged by the Irgun act, but said nothing more about it after his first burst of anger. 2 weeks after we left for the cottage, we were back in the city. Urgent Zionist meetings had been called to plan for the coming United Nations session that was to discuss the Palestine problem. My father was on the executive committee of his Zionist group and had to attend the meetings. For the rest of August, I saw my father only on Shabbat. He was gone in the mornings when I woke, and he returned at night when I was asleep. He was filled with fiery excitement, but it was clear that he was wearing himself out. I couldn't talk to him at all about his health. He refused to listen. Our Shabbat afternoon Talmud sessions had stopped. My father spent all of Shabbat resting so as to be prepared for each coming week of furious activity. I haunted the apartment, wandered the streets, barked at Manya, and thought of Danny. I remembered him telling me how much he admired and trusted his father, and I couldn't understand it. How could he admire and trust someone who wouldn't talk to him, even if that someone was his father? I hated his father. Once I even went up to the 3rd floor of the public library, hoping I might find Danny there. Instead, I found an old man sitting in the chair Danny had once occupied, staring nearsightedly at the pages of a scholarly journal. I went away from there and walked the streets blindly until it was time to go home to a lonely supper. In the 2nd week of September, I returned to school for the pre-registration student assembly and found myself sitting in the auditorium a few seats away from Danny. He looked thin and pale and constantly blinked his eyes. During the registrar's brief words of instruction concerning registration procedure, I saw Danny turn his head, stare at me for a moment, then turn slowly away. His face had remained expressionless. He hadn't even nodded a greeting. I sat very still, listening to the registrar, and felt myself get angry. "To hell with you, Danny Saunders," I thought. "You could at least show you know I'm alive. To hell with you and your fanatic father." I became so completely absorbed in my anger that I stopped listening to the instructions. I had to ask one of my classmates to repeat them to me after the assembly. "To hell with you, Danny Saunders," I kept saying to myself all that day. "I can live without your beard and earlocks with no trouble at all. You're not the center of the world, friend. To hell with you and your damn silence." By the time the fall semester officially began 2 days later, I'd promised myself to forget Danny as quickly as possible. I wasn't going to let him ruin another semester's work. One more report card like the one I had shown my father at the end of June, and I wouldn't even be graduated cum laude.
To hell with you, Danny Saunders, I kept saying to myself. You could at least have nodded your head. But it proved to be a good deal more difficult to forget him than I had anticipated, mostly because I'd been moved up into Rob Gershenson's Talmud class, where Danny's presence was always felt. Rob Gershenson was a tall, heavy-shouldered man in his late 60s with a long, pointed gray beard and thin, tapered fingers that seemed always to be dancing in the air. He used his hands constantly as he talked, and when he didn't talk, his fingers drummed on his desk or on the open Talmud in front of him. He was a gentle, kindly person with brown eyes, an oval face, and a soft voice, which at times was almost inaudible. He was an exciting teacher, though, and he taught Talmud the way my father did, in depth, concentrating for days on a few lines and moving on only when he was satisfied that we understood everything thoroughly. He laid heavy emphasis on the early and late medieval Talmudic commentators, and we were always expected to come to class knowing the Talmud text and these commentators in advance. Then he would call on one of us to read and explain the text. And the questions would begin. What does the Rambam say about Rabbi Akiva's question? He might ask of a particular passage, speaking in Yiddish. The rabbi spoke only Yiddish in the Talmud classes, but the students could speak Yiddish or English. I spoke English. Everyone agrees with the Rambam's explanation? Rav Gershenson might go on to ask. The Meiri does not. Very good. What does the Meiri say? And the Rashba? How does the Rashba explain Abaye's answer? And on and on. There was almost always a point at which the student who was reading the text would become bogged down by the cumulative intricacies of the questions and would stare down at his Talmud, drowning in the shame produced by his inability to answer. There would be a long, dreaded silence during which Rav Gershenson's fingers would begin to drum upon his desk or his Talmud. No? He would ask quietly. You do not know? How is it you do not know? Did you review beforehand? Yes? And you still do not know? There would be another long silence, and then Rav Gershenson would look around the room and say quietly, Who does know? And of course, Danny's hand would immediately go up, and he would offer the answer. Rav Gershenson would listen, nod, and his fingers would cease their drumming and take to the air as they accompanied his detailed review of Danny's answer. There were times, however, when Rav Gershenson did not nod at Danny's answer, but questioned him on it instead. And there would then ensue a lengthy dialogue between the two of them, with the class sitting by and listening in silence.